A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about Kaizen, that Japanese practice of incremental process improvement we dug into before. But he's asking the wider question. What other continuous improvement methodologies are out there, the ones companies actually use, and which of them translate into personal life? Because, let's be honest, a factory floor framework doesn't always survive contact with your Tuesday morning.
That's the exact right way to frame it. The corporate world has been cranking out improvement methodologies for decades, but the translation layer between reduced defect rate on assembly line 3 and I want to stop doom scrolling at 11p is where most of them collapse. So let's work through the ones that actually hold up.
Before you start rattling off acronyms, which I know you're about to do, let's set the filter. What makes a methodology portable from factory to person?
It has to work with a sample size of 1, no statistical process control requiring thousands of units. It has to tolerate the fact that your life isn't a controlled environment. And it has to survive the reality that you are both the operator and the quality inspector, which is a conflict of interest most corporate frameworks never had to solve.
The judge also being the defendant, so which ones clear that bar?
Let's start with the grandparent of all of them, PDCA. Plan, do, check, act. Sometimes called the Deming cycle, though Deming himself called it the Schuhart cycle after Walter Schuhart, who developed it at Bell Labs in the 1930s. Deming popularized it in Japan in the 1950s, and it became the engine underneath the Toyota production system.
Plan, do, check, act. Sounds almost too simple to be useful.
That's the deception. The power is in the check phase, which most people skip. The cycle forces you to treat every change as a hypothesis, not a solution. You plan what you'll do and what you expect to happen. You do it. You check. Did the result match the prediction? Then you act on what you learned. If it worked, standardize it. If it didn't, run a new cycle.
It's the scientific method wearing a business suit.
And for personal life, this is devastatingly effective when applied to habits. Say you want to wake up earlier. Most people just set an earlier alarm and suffer. The PDCA approach would be plan. I'll move my alarm back 15 minutes and put my phone across the room. Predict I'll feel groggy for 3 days, then adjust. Do it for a week. Check. Did I actually get up and how did I feel? Act. If the phone across the room trick worked, keep it. If it made you resent your own bedroom, try a sunrise alarm instead.
The part I like is that it bakes in the assumption that your first idea is probably wrong. You're not failing, you're just in the check phase.
That reframe alone is worth the price of admission. And PDCA scales down beautifully. You can run a cycle on something that takes 15 minutes. You can run one on a 6-month career pivot.
How does that work in practice when the thing you're trying to change involves other people? Like, say I want to improve how my team communicates. I can't just run a PDCA cycle on them like they're variables in my experiment.
No, and that's where the sample size of one filter matters. When other people are involved, you have to scope the PDCA to the part you control. So instead of improve team communication, which is a goal about other people's behavior, you scope it to, I will summarize action items at the end of every meeting and send them within 1 hour. That's entirely in your control. You predict it will reduce follow-up emails by some amount. You run it for 2 weeks. You check, did the follow-up email volume actually drop? If yes, standardize. If no, try a different intervention.
You don't PDCA other people. You PDCA your own contribution to the system and see what happens.
The moment you start trying to plan, do, check, act someone else's behavior, you become the controlling ex-partner nobody wants to get coffee with.
What about the one that sounds like a martial art?
Six Sigma was developed at Motorola in the mid-80s by an engineer named Bill Smith. The name refers to 6 standard deviations from the mean. The goal is 3.4 defects per million opportunities. It's hyper-statistical. DMAIC is the core framework. Define, measure, analyze, improve, control.
3.4 defects per million sounds like something that requires a spreadsheet and a minor in statistics.
And in its full corporate form, Six Sigma involves belts. Green belts, black belts, master black belts, the whole thing is a certification ladder. Which is exactly why I'd say it's the least portable of the major methodologies for personal use. You're not going to run a regression analysis on your sleep quality.
Unless you're a very specific kind of person who finds that fun.
There are dozens of them. But here's where Six Sigma does translate. The define and measure phases. Most personal improvement efforts fail because people skip straight to, I should exercise more, without defining what more means or measuring where they actually are. Six Sigma's discipline of operationalizing a vague goal into something countable, that part is gold.
You steal the front end and leave the statistical machinery behind.
Define the problem specifically. I'm out of shape becomes I can't climb 3 flights of stairs without breathing hard. Measure your baseline. How many flights can you do now? Now you've got something to improve against. That's Six Sigma, thinking without the black belt.
I want to push on that, though. Doesn't that kind of operationalizing sometimes miss the point? Like, I can measure how many flights of stairs I can climb, but maybe out of shape is actually about how I feel about my body, or whether I have the energy to play with my kids. The metric might capture the wrong thing.
That's a legitimate critique, and it's actually a known failure mode in corporate Six Sigma deployments. You optimize a metric that's easy to measure but poorly correlated with what you actually care about. Call centers that optimize average handle time end up with agents who rush customers off the phone. The metric improved, the experience got worse. So for personal use, you have to pair the measurement instinct with an honest check. Is this number actually a proxy for what matters? Sometimes, how I feel after playing with my kids for an hour is the real metric, and you just have to rate it 1 to 10 every day. It's subjective, but it's still measurement.
The Six Sigma contribution is less about statistical rigor and more about the refusal to stay vague.
I want to feel better is a wish. I will track my energy level at 3P every day on a 1 to 5 scale is a measurement system. It's not a control chart with standard deviation bands, but it's 100 times better than nothing.
Okay. So we've got PDCA as the scientific method, Six Sigma as the measurement discipline. What about lean? I hear that word thrown around a lot.
Lean comes out of the Toyota production system, same as Kaizen, and it's often confused with Kaizen. The distinction matters. Kaizen is the philosophy of continuous, small improvement. Lean is specifically about eliminating waste, Muda in Japanese. Muda in Japanese. Taichi Ono, the Toyota engineer who built the system, identified 7 types of waste, transport, inventory, motion, waiting, overproduction, overprocessing, and defects.
That's very Old Testament.
It kind of is. And here's the thing. Lean's waste lens is absurdly useful for personal life once you translate the categories. Transport waste in a factory is moving materials unnecessarily. In your life, it's context switching. Inventory waste is stuff piling up. Unread emails, clutter, commitments you said yes to and forgot about. Motion waste is unnecessary movement, looking for your keys every morning because they don't have a home.
Waiting waste feels self-explanatory.
It is, but people tolerate it in ways they wouldn't if they thought of it as waste. How much time do you spend waiting for apps to load? Waiting in lines you could skip? Waiting for someone who's chronically late? Overproduction is doing more than is needed. Over-preparing for meetings, cooking too much food that goes bad. Over-processing is adding steps that don't add value. Formatting the document that'll be read once. And defects or errors that require rework.
The overproduction one stings. I've definitely written paragraphs that became sentences.
And Lean gives you a vocabulary for spotting it. The personal life version of Lean is essentially a waste audit. You spend a week noting where you're doing things that don't move you toward anything you actually care about. Most people find 20 to 30% of their day is muda.
20 to 30% feels optimistic. I'd guess higher.
But even cutting 10% is a reclaimed decade over a career. That's the quiet violence of small waste.
Let me give you a concrete example from my own week, and you tell me which waste category it falls into. I spent 40 minutes on Tuesday rebuilding a slide deck because I'd saved over the original file and couldn't undo far enough back. Is that defects because I made an error? Or motion because I had to redo the work?
That's defects with a side of overprocessing. The defect was saving over the file. That's the error requiring rework. The overprocessing was the original formatting that apparently couldn't be reconstructed easily, which probably means you'd overbuilt the slides in the first place. But here's the lean move. Don't just classify it and feel bad. Ask what countermeasure would prevent it permanently. In a factory, they'd call it a polka yoke, a mistake-proofing device. For you, it might be always duplicate the file before making major changes, or use version history. The waste category is less important than the countermeasure.
The waste categories are diagnostic, not just labels for complaining.
If you just use them to say, look at all this waste, life is terrible. You've created a new waste category, meta-waste, complaining about waste without acting on it.
All right, we've covered the Japanese manufacturing trifecta. What else is out there? I've heard of something called the OODA loop.
Oh, this one's different. OODA comes from military strategy, not manufacturing. Colonel John Boyd, a U Air Force fighter pilot, developed it in the 1950s and 60s. OODA stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act. Boyd's insight was that in aerial combat, and by extension any competitive situation, the pilot who cycles through OODA faster wins. It's not about having the perfect plan, it's about having a faster decision loop than your opponent.
It's a tempo weapon.
Boyd called it, getting inside the enemy's OODA loop. You're making decisions faster than they can respond, so by the time they react to what you did, you've already moved again. They're always responding to a situation that no longer exists.
How does that translate when there's no enemy?
The opponent becomes your own hesitation, procrastination, analysis paralysis, the gap between knowing what to do and doing it. OODA is fantastic for personal decision-making because it short-circuits perfectionism. Observe what's happening. Orient, this is the crucial step Boyd emphasized, where you interpret what you observe through your mental models, experience, and context. Decide on a course of action, then immediately observe the results and start again.
The orient step sounds like where most people get stuck.
Boyd said orientation is the Schwerpunkt, the focal point of the whole loop. It's where your biases live, your assumptions, your blind spots. In personal life, orienting poorly means you misread a situation and make decisions based on a distorted picture. A partner says something neutral, you orient it as criticism. You decide to get defensive, you act snappy. The loop was fast, but wrong.
OODA speed without orientation quality is just being efficiently wrong.
And that's actually the critique of OODA in personal contexts. It can become a justification for impulsiveness. I'm just cycling fast is not the same as cycling well. But used deliberately, OODA is a great antidote to overthinking. Give yourself a time box for each phase. Observe for 5 minutes. Orient for 5. Decide in 2. You'll be stunned how much faster you move through decisions that were paralyzing you.
Can we do a real example? Give me a decision someone might be stuck on and walk it through OODA with time boxes.
Classic 1. Should I take this job offer or stay where I am? Someone's been agonizing for 3 weeks. OODA approach, observe, spend 10 minutes writing down everything you actually know about both options. Not what you fear or hope, just the facts. Salary, commute, team size, growth potential, what people who've worked there actually say. Orient, 10 minutes. What are your mental models? Are you evaluating this as a career move or a lifestyle move? Are you biased towards safety because you got burned in the last job switch? Are you overweighting the salary bump because it's easy to compare, and underweighting culture because it's hard? Decide. 5 minutes. Based on what you observed and how you oriented, what's the call? Act, send the email, accept or decline. The whole thing takes 30 minutes instead of 3 weeks.
If you get new information after you act,
then you're already back in the observe phase of the next loop. The loop never stops. That's the point. It's not decide once and live with it forever. It's decide now with the best information you have and keep cycling.
There's something appealing about a framework that treats hesitation as the adversary. Most productivity advice treats time as the enemy.
Boyd would say time is the terrain, not the enemy. The enemy is the gap between your loop speed and the situation's demands.
All right, so we've got PDCA, Six Sigma, Lean, OODA. What about something newer? The tech industry must have spawned something in the last 20 years.
The obvious one is Agile, but Agile is more of a philosophy than a methodology. It spawned Scrum, Kanban, all the rest. For personal use, I think the most interesting one is actually Kanban. It came out of Toyota as well, Taichi Ono again, in the 1940s. Kanban means signboard or visual card in Japanese. The core idea is visualizing work and limiting work in progress.
The board with the sticky notes.
That's the one. Columns for to do, doing, done. But the part most people miss is the WIP limit, work in progress limit. You set a maximum number of items allowed in the doing column. If the limit is 3, you cannot start a fourth thing until one of the 3 moves to done.
That's the part my brain would rebel against.
Everyone's brain rebels against it, because we've been trained to equate busyness with productivity. But the data is brutal on this. Task switching carries a cognitive cost. There's a famous study from the University of California, Irvine by Gloria Mark that found it takes an average of 23 minutes and 15 seconds to refocus after an interruption. If you're juggling 6 things, you're bleeding focus constantly. WIP limits force you to finish before starting.
Kanban is essentially a commitment device against your own multitasking instincts.
And for personal life, a personal Kanban board, physical or digital, can be revelatory. You see visually that you've got 17 things in progress and nothing in done. The board doesn't lie. It's also great for couples or families. A shared Kanban board for household projects eliminates the "I thought you were handling that" conversations.
That alone might save marriages.
There's no longitudinal study yet, but I'd fund it.
What I'm curious about is the psychology of the IP limit. Why is it so hard to stick to? I intellectually understand that multitasking is inefficient, but I still feel this pull to start new things before finishing old ones.
There's a few things going on. One is the completion bias. Starting a new task gives you a little dopamine hit because your brain treats initiated a thing as progress, even though nothing has actually moved forward. The second is that finishing is where the hard parts live. Starting a project is fun because it's all possibility and no constraints. Finishing means confronting the messy middle, the parts you didn't think through, the last 10% that takes 50% of the effort. The WIP limit forces that confrontation. You can't escape into a new project because the board won't let you.
The board is the bad guy, not you. Sorry, I'd love to start that novel, but my doing column is at capacity.
That's exactly how you use it. Externalize the constraints so you don't have to rely on willpower. Willpower is a terrible project manager.
You mentioned theory of constraints earlier. What is that?
Theory of constraints was developed by Eliyahu Goldratt, an Israeli physicist turned management consultant. He introduced it in his 1984 book, The Goal, which is written as a novel, a business novel, which was unusual at the time. The core idea is that any system has exactly one bottleneck, one constraint, that limits its throughput at any given moment.
That's a bold claim.
Goldratt's argument is that in any chain of processes, there's always one weakest link. You can improve everything else and get zero system-wide improvement because the constraint is still throttling the whole thing. The methodology is 5 focusing steps. Identify the constraint, exploit it, meaning squeeze maximum output from it without investing more. Subordinate everything else to the constraint. Elevate the constraint if needed, then repeat, because the constraint will have moved.
It's bottleneck whack-a-mole.
And for personal life, this is incredibly clarifying. Most people spread improvement efforts across 5 areas at once: sleep, diet, exercise, work focus, relationships, and make tiny progress on all of them. Theory of constraints says, what's the one thing that, if improved, would make everything else easier or irrelevant?
For a lot of people, that's probably sleep.
Often it is. If you're sleep deprived, your willpower is shot, your focus is fragmented, your mood is unstable. Trying to improve your diet while sleep-deprived is like trying to paint a room during an earthquake. Fix the sleep first. Once that's no longer the constraint, the next bottleneck will reveal itself. Maybe it's your morning routine or your email habits, but you tackle them one at a time in order of leverage.
How do you actually identify the constraint? If I'm feeling stuck in multiple areas, how do I know which one is the real bottleneck?
Goldratt has a diagnostic question. If you could wave a magic wand and remove one obstacle, which one would create the biggest cascade of improvement? Another approach is to look for the constraint that's upstream of other problems. If you're struggling with diet and exercise and focus, sleep is upstream of all 3. If you're struggling with career progress and relationship quality and creative output, maybe the constraint is how you manage your attention, not any of those individual domains.
The constraint isn't always the most painful problem. It's the one that's causing the most other problems.
And that's counterintuitive. People tend to attack the problem that's screaming loudest, not the one that's quietly causing three other problems downstream. Goldratt would say you're treating symptoms while the bottleneck laughs at you from upstream.
This feels like the antidote to the thing where people read a self-improvement book and try to change 15 things on Monday morning.
That's exactly what it is. Goldratt would call that activating everything instead of exploiting the constraint. Activation without exploitation is just noise. You're busy, but you're not improving throughput.
Throughput being, in personal terms, the stuff that actually matters getting done.
Output that moves your life forward, not just activity that fills the day.
Far we've covered frameworks that are mostly about process and efficiency. Are there any that are more about reflection and learning?
There's one that fits that profile perfectly, the After Action Review, or AAR, developed by the U Army in the 1970s, formalized in the 80s. After every mission or training exercise, the unit gathers and answers four questions: what was supposed to happen? What actually happened? Why was there a difference? What will we do differently next time?
That's almost insultingly simple.
Yet the military considers it one of the most powerful learning tools ever developed. The key is that it's done immediately after the action, while memory is fresh and it's blameless. The goal is learning, not accountability. Rank is left at the door. A private can tell a colonel what went wrong if the culture is healthy.
I can see why that last part fails in a lot of organizations.
It's the hardest part. But for personal use, you don't have rank dynamics to fight. You can do a personal AAR on anything, a difficult conversation, a presentation, a date, a weekend with the in-laws, what was supposed to happen. What actually happened? Why the gap? What will I change? It takes 5 minutes, and it prevents you from repeating the same mistake indefinitely.
There's a version of this I've seen in software teams, the retrospective.
Yes, the Agile retrospective is essentially a descendant of the AAR. Software teams do them at the end of every sprint. The standard format is, what went well, what didn't go well, what should we start doing, what should we stop doing? Some teams add, what did we learn, or what still puzzles us?
You've actually used this personally, right? The four-section template.
When I was still practicing, I used a personal retrospective every Friday afternoon. Four sections, what happened this week, what did I miss, what will I do differently, and a one-line lesson. It took 15 minutes, and it was probably the highest leverage 15 minutes of my week.
What's an example of a one-line lesson that stuck?
Patients don't remember what you said. They remember how you made them feel, but they sue you for what you didn't document. That was a Friday afternoon lesson after a close call.
That's two lessons.
It's one lesson with a semicolon. Don't be pedantic.
I'm a sloth. Pedantry is one of the few fast things I have.
But the point stands. The personal retrospective is the AAR adapted for weekly cadence, and it compounds. 52 one-line lessons a year is a book's worth of hard-won wisdom.
Let me try to synthesize this, because we've covered a lot of ground. We've got PDCA as the scientific method backbone, Six Sigma for measurement discipline, Lean for waste elimination, OODA for decision speed, Kanban for visualizing and limiting work in progress, theory of constraints for bottleneck focus, and DARs and retrospectives for structured reflection. That's a toolbox.
The question is how to use the toolbox without becoming the person who spends more time optimizing their productivity system than actually doing things.
That is the trap, isn't it?
It's the great irony of personal improvement methodologies. You can get so deep into tweaking your Kanban board and running your retrospectives that you've built a full-time job of self-optimization that produces nothing except more self-optimization.
The infinite recursion problem, like a camera filming its own screen.
So the skill is knowing which tool to reach for and when to put the toolbox down. My rule of thumb, if you're stuck and don't know why, run a personal AAR on your last attempt. If you're overwhelmed and everything feels urgent, go theory of constraints and find the bottleneck. If you're busy but not productive, do a lean waste audit. If you're procrastinating on a decision, OODA with a time box. If you want to build a habit, PDCA. If you're juggling too many projects, Kanban with a WIP limit.
That's a useful decision tree. What about Six Sigma? Where does that fit in personal life?
Six Sigma's personal application is mostly in the define phase. When you have a vague sense of dissatisfaction, I'm not healthy, my finances are a mess, my career is stalled, the Six Sigma instinct to operationalize is valuable. Turn my finances are a mess into my credit card balance grew by $1,200 in the last 3 months, and I don't know where the money went. Now you have something measurable to improve.
Six Sigma is the diagnosis tool, not the treatment.
Once you've defined and measured, you probably switch to PDCA, or Theory of Constraints, for the actual improvement work. Six Sigma's full DMAIC cycle is overkill for personal use unless you genuinely enjoy statistical analysis.
I want to push on something. All these methodologies assume you know what improvement means. They're about closing the gap between where you are and where you want to be. But what if the problem is that you don't know where you want to be?
That's the weakness in every single one of these frameworks. They're all means-to-ends methodologies. They don't help you choose the ends. PDCA will get you efficiently to a goal, but if the goal is wrong, you've efficiently arrived at the wrong place. OODA will speed up your decisions, but if your orientation is toward values you don't actually hold, you'll make fast bad decisions.
There's a prerequisite step that none of these frameworks address.
And it's the hardest step, clarifying what you actually care about. I don't think there's a corporate methodology for that, because corporations don't have existential crises about their purpose, or, when they do, they hire consultants who charge seven figures to facilitate offsites with sticky notes and existential dread.
The personal equivalent is probably therapy, or a long walk, or a conversation with someone who knows you well.
Or just sitting with the discomfort of the question instead of reaching for a framework to answer it. Not everything needs a methodology. Some things just need time and honesty.
That feels like a good place to land. But before we wrap, I want to ask about something you mentioned in passing, the idea that these frameworks can be combined. Is there a danger in mixing them?
The danger is incoherence. If you're running PDCA cycles on a habit, while also doing a lean waste audit, while also maintaining a Kanban board, while also doing weekly retrospectives, you've built a management bureaucracy for a company of one. The overhead eats the benefit.
The advice is, pick one.
Pick one at a time based on what's actually hurting. If your problem is clarity, do a retrospective. If it's execution, do Kanban. If it's direction, none of the above. Go figure out what matters. The tools are there to serve a need, not to fill your time.
If someone wants to go deeper on any of these, where should they start?
For PDCA, read Deming's Out of the Crisis. It's dense but foundational. For Lean, The Toyota Way by Jeffrey Liker is the standard. For Theory of Constraints, Goldratt's The Goal is a good read even as a novel. For OODA, Boyd's own writings are hard to find, but Robert Corum's biography, Boyd, the Fighter Pilot Who Changed the Art of War, is excellent. For AARs, the U Army's own field manuals are publicly available and surprisingly readable. And for Kanban, Personal Kanban by Jim Benson and Tony Ann DeMaria Berry is the go-to.
That's a reading list that'll keep someone busy for a while.
Or they could just start with a 5-minute AAR tonight on something that didn't go well today. Zero reading required. The best methodology is the one you actually use.
There's the episode in one line. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1908, astronomers at an observatory on the Kamchatka Peninsula recorded a transient lunar phenomenon, a reddish glow near the crater Aristarchus, which they attributed to sunlight refracting through a cloud of volcanic ash suspended in Earth's upper atmosphere rather than any activity on the moon itself.
A reddish glow attributed to volcanic ash. Sounds like my last attempt at cooking.
I have no follow-up to any of that.
Here's the open question we'll leave on the table. All these methodologies were designed for factories and armies and software teams, environments where the goal is given, and the only question is how to get there faster or with fewer defects. The personal domain is messier because you have to supply the goal yourself. The most sophisticated improvement system in the world won't save you if you're optimizing towards something you don't actually want. So the real work might be upstream of all of this. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back soon.
See you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.